Welcome to the Mom Manual. Motherhood doesn't come with instructions, but it should. We are on a mission to highlight ordinary moms doing extraordinary things to build the ultimate mom manual. Every week, I have the distinct honor of speaking with women about the lessons they've learned and the inspiration that got them to where they are today. Join us for a conversation that will spark creativity, provide actionable tips, and celebrate the ordinary and extraordinary moments of motherhood. The Mom Manual starts now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mom Manual. I have another amazing guest for you today, and we are going to be talking all things sleep. Dr. Meredith Broderick is a Stanford-trained, triple board-certified neurologist specializing in sleep and behavioral sleep medicine. This is very exciting to have a doctor on with us today. So welcome to Dr. Meredith Broderick.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We're so excited to have you. I love to learn the science side behind sleep, and you also have the practical side of sleep as well. Can you give us more information about what you're doing? Just let our guests know who you are.
Well, I'm a medical doctor, and I've been a professor of neurology at Case Western before I moved into private practice. And I've worked in a number of different practice settings, underserved. And then now I'm in Seattle, and I work one-on-one with patients in my telehealth clinic. And I also have some educational roles online on Instagram, social media. And I'm also helping a company called Oslo Sleep develop ways to help utilize technology for sleep and wellness.
Triple threat right there. I love it. You're doing a little bit of everything, right?
Yes, that's right.
So today, Meredith has prepared three different sleep takeaways for us, which I'm really excited to jump into. So without further ado, let's start on the first one, Meredith.
Sleep is a learned behavior. I had a professor at Stanford. He used to say, you know, sleep is a physiologic need, just like food and water. But the way that we learn to sleep, is learned. So it's something that we're taught by our parents, or maybe not taught by our parents. And I think that's really important because, you know, on one hand, if you're not sleeping so well, you can learn to become a better sleeper.
And this, I think this is a little bit controversial because we do sometimes have certified sleep consultants who come on the podcast and they say, no, your baby already knows how to sleep. And then, you know, we just have different viewpoints on this. I have heard it the same way as eating is a biological mechanism that babies do. Like, we know how to eat, right? It is innate into us. But if you think about the first time you feed baby, you know, puree or an avocado, and they stick their tongue out and they don't really know how to swallow it, and they're not sure what to do with the texture, that's what I think about as sleep, right? So you need to actually continue to feed them so they learn. Same thing with sleep. So tell us more about this learned behavior. What happens if you don't teach a behavior to sleep? What does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's really two aspects of this. One is there is the maturation of the brain and the nervous system. And when you're a mom, you see that process unfold in front of you as things constantly change over time. That's the one thing that's a little bit challenging is just when you think you're getting the hang of it, they like to change it up on you, right? But I think that the other thing with sleep is that we're supposed to be adaptable. So we should be able to adapt to our environment. And that's why, you know, there's not a one size. We always say there's not a one size fits all. You know, there are different cultures, there are different lifestyle demands. So we kind of want to mold things for our child, for our culture, for our lifestyle, and also respect and understand kind of the typical development, because it does kind of respect the pattern in terms of, you know, there's more of an irregularity and then there's two naps and then there's one nap and then there's no nap kind of thing.
That's really interesting. So you know what you brought up that we haven't talked on here before about is the cultural aspect, right, of sleeping.
Yeah.
First thing that pops into my mind is in Europe, co-sleeping is very popular, right? And in the United States, it's a big no-no. It's always baby on their back alone in their crib, right? So Can you talk through how do you work with a parent that says, you know, I want to co-sleep, or I don't know what other cultural examples would be that maybe is atypical to what we think of as a safe sleep environment or a typical sleep environment in the US?
Yeah, I mean, we think that human beings, you know, as hunters and gatherers, slept together communally because it was a way to conserve heat. It's very cold outside at night, and that was probably, you know, the natural thing that happened. And I think timing is also can be different. I mean, there are some cultures where they nap, they have dinner a little bit later, they go to bed later, they might sleep more in two periods. The whole reason, I think, one of the reasons why the bed sharing is kind of a no-no, it has to do with sudden infant death. And just the epidemiological data around that is very, very strong. It's been one of the biggest, I think, public health initiatives, maybe in the past 100 years in terms of success. Mm-hmm. And then at least that's the way the medical profession views it. So that's why the bed sharing is really discouraged, is it's meant to be preventative, like wearing a seatbelt. You know, it's not that when all goes well that it's harmful or good or bad, but the idea there is that it's saving lives.
So how do we reconcile that with other countries who are prolifically bed sleeping, co-sharing?
Well, I think that in other countries, they do have this initiative too. I mean, I think it depends on the country that you're talking about. But we just know in terms of like data, if we look at epidemiology, that is a risk factor of bed sharing.
From suffocation.
Yeah, from suffocation. I mean, suffocation is what we think happens, but there's probably some predisposing genetic trait in that baby in terms of respiratory drive. And like, it's like these two different or these different mechanisms happen coincidentally. So whereas one child, they might not be susceptible to that because they would move around and breathe, but we don't know who those babies are that are susceptible. I mean, I think people think of it as like a cultural judgment, but like from a medical perspective, it really is just like wearing a seatbelt. It's like, we don't know when the accident's going to happen.
No, that definitely makes sense. So then, you know, talk to us a little more about other learned behaviors. So let's focus on just the United States, because that's predominantly our listeners. So we know babies to be in their own crib, free of loose blankets. That's why we all wear sleep sacks, and we have our sound machines, and we have our blackout curtains, kind of the triple threat that we always hear in terms of helping babies sleep. But what else does it mean to learn a behavior of sleep?
There's a pattern, you know, the brain wants to be a pattern recognizer. So we're always talking about these sleep rituals, you know, you take a bath and then maybe you give your baby a massage, you change their diaper, you feed them, you put them in their sleep sack. And so the baby starts to recognize, well, after A comes B and after B comes C, and it's sort of this cue, it's a learned cue. It happens exactly the same way in adults, where when I deal with, you know, adults with insomnia, we try to set up these sleep rituals where we're aligning a ritual with timing and some other things. But in the United States, it's very pro, like fall asleep on your own, learning to fall asleep on your own and learning that that's safe. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's necessarily what comes naturally to children because, you know, as I said earlier, as hunters and gatherers, that's probably not the natural way that we slept. But for those of us that are thinking about SIDS risk, or maybe we're just adults who don't sleep so well with a child next to us, and then we don't feel as great, we're trying to get our children to sleep independently, fall asleep independently, so that when they wake up in the middle of the night, which people do wake up during sleep cycles or after sleep cycles, we want them to be able to put themselves back down independently.
Yeah. And that, you know, from all of my personal research as a mom of four, my company research as a founder of a sleep company, it's always come back to that one line, fall asleep independently. So when we look at, and I'm guilty of this too, nursing baby to sleep, rocking baby to sleep, you know, massaging their back to sleep. You see parents laying in their baby's crib and being a ninja and, you know, rolling out of the room. All of these things are amazing and they're going to help your baby get to sleep. But at 2 a.m. when your baby wakes up, they are going to look for that rocking, that back rub, that nursing to sleep. And if that's not there, they're going to start crying because they don't have the learned trait to fall asleep independently. So that's a really hard thing to do though, as a parent, right?
Yes.
That is where I think comes in sleep training, of course, but that's also where you hear like the cry it out method, because how do you get to that point, right? Baby wants to be held to sleep, especially when you think about a newborn who spent 9 months in a womb, super cozy, cramped, tiny space. And now they're supposed to be stretched out, laid on their back. That's a super jarring experience. So how do you transition those first nights? Like what, if you had, you know, two or three kind of takeaways, and I know every baby's different and we can't get into a one-on-one sleep session here. And that's why there are certified sleep consultants and they're so popular. But, you know, what's just a couple tips for those first few nights for the parent that's like, I just cannot listen to my baby cry and cry.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key is to do it at the right time. Like, you don't want to cry out a newborn. But I think when you're ready, and I think parents know when they're ready, because a lot of times they're really having a hard time and they need to do it for them, you know, for their own well-being, for everyone's well-being.
Yeah.
I would say make a plan, make, you know, just understand that you're going to feel anxious and it's going to take a while. And the average first night is going to be 40 minutes of crying. And maybe you and your partner can watch a movie you've been really wanting to watch, and maybe you don't need to listen to it. You can put the baby on a monitor, but not listen, but watch to make sure you see they're safe. And then know that the next night is probably going to be like half of that. And then know that it may only take like three nights, you know, it can be really fast. So I just kind of, I like to be more of a guide and tell people this is what to expect so that they don't go, oh my gosh, it's 40 minutes. But like, that would be kind of like average.
And it's that's a long actually time. Shocking. 40 minutes is a really long time. So I would almost say that's the like rip the bandaid off method, if we want to call it something. But I remember with my first daughter, it was at 6 weeks. My husband was like, okay, because we had the bassinet next to our bed and she would have these movements that would wake both of us up just all night long. Even if it was just her, I always joke, she made this dolphin noise where it's like, and you know, she wasn't crying, but it was just, it would wake us up. So at 6 weeks, we're like, okay, we've got to get to sleep. You know, he at this point had well gone back to work. I was still on maternity leave, but you know, and this was my first, so I could sleep when she slept and it wasn't as bad. Now, child two, three, and four, different story, but we put her in her crib. Her room was next to ours. And yeah, in hindsight, it might've been 40 minutes. It felt like a lifetime. And I was like, I want to go back in. And he's like, no, no, no. Like, let her do it and cry it out. But that is a bit controversial. And tell me why, where's the controversy that surrounds the cry it out method, which is really what you're describing, right? Letting them cry for 40 minutes. It's quite a long time.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it comes from this attachment theory and people who are pro attachment theory, which is describing the way you're supposed to bond with your baby in the healthiest manner. And when they make an emotional bid to connect or cry out, that you go to them. And so I very much understand that. I don't think I understood it as well as I did once I became a mother myself, but I like to think of it like another tool that I used was like have a checklist of the things that you would be worried about.
Yeah.
And if you do need to go in, you can check those things very quickly, you know, or you can check them off when you put your baby down. I fed them, I changed their diaper. You know, for me, I was not a strict cry it out person. Like I would go in there and check the diaper because that's like the one thing I knew I couldn't necessarily see.
Yeah.
And I would just check it. But I knew that my kid's not going to go to sleep if they have a big poop in there. So yeah. And then night diapers were like a really big friend of mine too. Just to go in really quick, change it, and then come back out. So you're not staying a long time. You can kind of check off whatever your list of things is that you're worried about, but then you can reassure yourself, okay, I've met all their needs. I am forming that secure attachment. I am, you know, responding to them, but I see that they're okay. And the cry really is, I think of it like a question. Like I tell my patients, the cry is a question. Like when babies cry, that's the only way they have to communicate. Right. And we think of it as intrinsically being negative, but it's actually a question. Am I okay? Am I okay? And if you don't, you know, oh my gosh, what's wrong? Let me fix it. Yeah. Then you're answering them with no action. You are okay. And so in that way, it is kind of still, you know, maintaining that secure attachment by saying, I'm the parent, I judge when you're okay. And I let you know that you're okay by my reaction.
Interesting. Yeah, that's such an interesting way to look at it. I never thought of that before. So the cry is a question. And I like what you're saying with the check mark. So they're crying and the question could be, you know, does the baby have a dirty diaper? And there's really not that many things to look at. Are they hungry? Are they clean? That's about it, right? I mean, there's what more, are they sick? Do they need medicine, right? But what more other kind of questions is there even to answer? It's pretty basic.
There aren't that many. Yeah, there's only going to be a couple things, you know? Yeah.
No, that makes total sense. So my question for you then, as a mom, not as a doctor, when did you start sleep training for your kids?
So my first child, I have two children, one's a 5-year-old, one's a 1-year-old. With the first one, I want to say she was like 4 or 5 months.
Okay.
And then, and it was like, no, I had reached a point where it just wasn't happening. Like I couldn't, you know.
As a parent, you are desperate for sleep. You're like, yes. I can't do this anymore. I've been up, you know, 4, 3, 4 times a night for 6 months now. This is crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And you start to realize when you go in there, they're fine. And you're like trying to set them down and creep away. And they wake up the minute you put them down, and then you know it's time. Okay. The second one, it was, I think after maybe 2 months or 3 months, it was a lot earlier. I felt a lot more comfortable around it.
So I was really early then at 6 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. You were really early.
But I will tell you, my first daughter, we were so good with her. So the rituals you talked about, you know, cause we had one and she slept by, I would say probably 8 weeks, 12 hours. I mean, she was sleeping through the night. And even as like a 1-year-old, she'd wake up in the morning at like 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. I mean,
we'd
bottle in, you know, my husband and I maybe went out the night before, we were tired and we just like let her sleep again till like noon. We're like, what is going on? This girl. And now she's almost 12. Girlfriend loves her sleep. So
that's awesome.
Child to child. All right, let's jump into the next. So this is talking about sleep health, which I love this because we've never talked about sleep health on the podcast, but sleep health is multifaceted. Tell us about that.
I mean, I think a lot of people are looking at sleep trackers and maybe even using like these smart monitors. And I think there's kind of an over focus on sleep duration. Mm-hmm. How long is my child sleeping? But sleep is more multifaceted than that. We care a lot about satisfaction. We care a lot about timing, regularity. We care a lot about something called sleep efficiency. So how much you're asleep in bed. So in other words, you're not awake a long time that you're in the bed. Of course, these things are a little bit different with babies versus adults, but in general, the rules and the principles are very similar. So it's really just to look at all these different angles and not kind of get over obsessed with the duration. Like how long is it?
Right. So then what is most important? Is that REM sleep? I mean, how, and yes, I know the owlet sock monitor, there's others that are similar and parents are tracking every second. And, you know, this is the quality of the sleep. I don't know how those figure that out, but what as a doctor are you looking at as the one metric that parents should kind of think about?
What I always say is that I think the most surprising thing when like I used to teach doctors in training is like parents know when something's wrong. Mm-hmm. Like they have a spidey sense. And so really trust that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and so the subjective report is really important. Like don't make it all about like trackers and numbers and does this chart match up with what I'm seeing? Like if you think something's off, if something doesn't seem right to you, even if your pediatrician says, I'm going to watch and wait, something's off, like pursue it, you know?
Well, and that's, you know, with a lot of these trackers, we're seeing that they're alerting when there's not an issue, right? And
yes.
So for that already anxious parent to get an alert, is it a false alert? Is it a true alert? You know, what is this? to disrupt the sleep in the middle of the night to go check on baby. Are they too hot? Or that, you know, I don't know if it's like we almost have, like you said, too much information. We're too informed.
Oh, that's exactly right. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah.
And then so going back to actual like sleep health. So as an adult, I can tell you if I don't sleep, I get sick, period. Like if there's been, you know, times where I always think of like, I compare the first few months of child to being in like a bender in Las Vegas, right? Like where you're up till 4 a.m. gambling and then you're waking up early at the pool, whatever that is, right? So if I do that, then I just get sick. Like my body starts breaking down. Like I get sick. Also, I don't eat as healthy because I'm tired. So I'm not making good choices. For me, I'm not working out if I'm exhausted, which again, then like ties back into the food. If I'm not working out, I'm not drinking water. So like, and then again, it ends in me typically getting sick. So for babies though, like what does that look like if they aren't getting that good quality sleep? What happens psychologically, mentally, development, you know, all the things, what happens?
I mean, in babies versus little kids, going to be a little bit different, but there is this myth that kind of like the more like sleep begets sleep, or like not sleeping begets not sleeping. And I think that's true to some extent where, you know, there is this, kids get like more hyperactive, they don't learn as well. Even really little kids, we think that those naps are really important for learning. So trying to, you know, get those milestones, the language, the motor skills. But in school, when you have like younger kids, then that's when we start worrying about like, is the ADHD kind of suspected diagnosis, is that really a sleep problem? Because kids don't really get sleepy the way adults do. They tend to be more like have an attentional or hyperactive way of behaving.
Yeah. What about for more like specifically for infants though? And let's just talk about like being sick or not sick, like just the general health quality. I mean, does that align with adults or?
Yeah. I mean, like for instance, you know, we think that there's a better response to vaccines, you know, that the immunity is higher when kids sleep better. Those are really the main things, but also just like the well-being of the child. And then if the child does not have well-being, then the parents stressed out too. It's not a life-threatening thing. I mean, I don't want to make it seem like that, but I just think it does affect the well-being very much, like across the board.
Yeah. And, you know, for me personally, you know, I talked about my first daughter who was this wonder sleeper, my fourth, which is my baby Luke, who is now almost six. He was waking up every hour and a half at 6 months old. And it was like, I was getting no sleep. I had three other kids who were 3, 4, and 5. It was chaos in the household. And I think that at least in my households, the mother's mood really sets the tone for the whole family. So, you know, when I had him waking up all night, he was never getting those good stretches. He was constantly sick as an infant. During the day, he was just crying. He was colicky. He was just like uncomfortable. And even like naps, he was never getting any quality sleep. And so I wasn't getting sleep. I was getting sick more often. It just was this really bad spiral in our family. And it was a very different experience because my other three kids slept generally well, right? The first one was great. The other two were generally fine, sleeping through the night, you know, whatever we want to call that, by about 4 months where, you know, maybe I went in once, but he was waking up every hour and a half. I mean, it was like a newborn. And so just kind of comparing and contrasting having three kids in a generally good sleep situation and having one not, I was like, this is horrible. Like, mm-hmm. It is so different. I'm so upset. I remember looking at him. He was probably 3.5 months old at the time. Again, like a newborn every hour and a half. And I remember thinking, I hate you, which is like the most horrible thing to say as a mother to her baby. But I was like, just go to sleep. Like I was angry at him, like my precious little newborn. I was so mad at him. And mm-hmm. I had never felt like that before. And I never had postpartum with any of my kids. So there was nothing like that. It was, I was just freaking exhausted. Right. So I think that with all of the, you know, the sleep stuff, to me, it equals like illness. But you're saying maybe not necessarily, or you mentioned immunity's higher and that wears off illness, or talk to us a little bit more on that. Because I know, especially this time of year, a lot of people are getting sick.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the functions of sleep is to improve the immune response and immune function. And it becomes like a vicious cycle, because if your immune function is down and you're stressed, then you're more likely to get sick. Your illness is going to last longer. You're not maybe going to get as good of a response to the flu vaccine you're getting.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Sleep is very important, as we know. What about for brain function? Another thing that I always heard is if your baby's not sleeping, their brain is not developing. So a smart baby is a well-rested baby. Is there any evidence on this, or any long-term twin studies or other that you've ever come across?
Yeah, I mean, your baby is going to sleep, you know? So, I mean, sleep is a physiologic need. And that's the other side of the coin, is like, your baby is going to sleep. People are going to get sleep. And like in adults, what we would see is they might fall asleep at the wheel, you know, because their brain is going to get it one way. But we want to try to get the sleep in this healthy manner that we know is optimal. And so that is going to help your baby with development, especially like, I think the piece that's really important is like learning. It doesn't mean that they wouldn't, like if it was twins, it doesn't mean that they wouldn't necessarily reach that milestone. But like, I'll give you an example. Like I've seen twins, identical twins, where one, for whatever reason, has really big adenotonsillar hypertrophy and has sleep apnea.
Yeah.
And the other twin is much larger, and they're growing more because they don't have a sleep disorder. And wow. Then all of a sudden you treat the smaller twin and that twin catches up.
Wow. That's huge. Yeah.
So it affects even like their size. Yeah. Like their literal growth.
Literally. Wow. That's so we need to get our sleep. Today's episode was brought to you by Dreamland Baby. I want to introduce you to a product that hundreds of thousands of parents use to help their baby sleep: the Dreamland Baby Weighted Sleep Sack. Hi, I'm Tara Williams, host of the Mom Manual and founder of Dreamland Baby. When my son Luke was 6 months old, he was still waking up every hour and a half. I was completely exhausted, frustrated, and at my wit's end. Sound familiar? My solution: to create a gently weighted sleep sack that babies can safely wear to help them feel calm, fall asleep faster, and stay asleep longer. The award-winning, doctor-approved Dream Weighted Sleep Sack and Swaddle features our proprietary CoverCom technology, evenly distributed weight from your baby's shoulders to toes, to help naturally reduce stress and allow your little one to feel relaxed and sleep soundly. If you're struggling to get your baby to sleep for longer stretches and go down easier, you're not alone. This product was a game changer for my son and can be for your family too. And right now, we've got a special discount exclusive to Mom Manual listeners. Use code MOMMANUAL15 at checkout to get 15% off site-wide. Isn't it time for you to invest in rest? Our last takeaway is no more watch and wait. What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is, I don't know if you've encountered this, but pediatricians love to say watch and wait. And I think there's a reason for that in defense of them, because, you know, we can get a little bit worried and anxious as parents. But there are things that, especially in sleep medicine, I want parents to be really proactive about. You know, I'm very biased as a sleep doctor towards like sleep apnea diagnosis and treatment for, you know, the example I gave you is one of them. But things like malocclusions, tongue ties, functional airway development, you know, adenotonsillar hypertrophy, treatment of allergies, these things all impact sleep. And even sleep training, I think that, you know, when you do it younger, it's more beneficial, right? Because it's like that much more time that your child was sleeping in a healthier manner. Mm. So, and just in general, I don't want to watch and wait forever, because early intervention, just as a neurologist, I've seen like basically across the board, we want to intervene and help these kids, the younger, the better.
Yeah, no, I think that makes total sense. And I love your point earlier about, you know, the mother or father really does have that intuition. And I can speak to that from personal experience. And I think if you interviewed 100 moms, they'd say, I knew even when my pediatrician said no. So earlier you said you started sleep training with your daughter 4 or 5 months, your son at 2 to 3 months as your second. Yeah. So are you, when you say earlier, are you recommending more closer to that 2 to 3 months to start getting that healthy sleep habits?
Well, I think that parents should do it when they're ready. I don't, I think those were the right times for those children. Like one of the reasons why my older one, it took longer is she had really bad reflux. And so she would like throw up a lot. And so I think I was just a lot more worried about not going in. But I think you can, like 4 months is kind of, I think, probably average.
And then that's when you run into the 4 month sleep regression though, right?
So yeah,
you're trying to train right as that big growth spurt is happening. This has been so good, Meredith. I could talk to you all day about all this stuff. I love the perspective, both as a neurologist and, you know, really that more focus on sleep, but then you are doing these one-on-one sleep training. So you understand how I would say the average or modern parent, whatever we want to call it, the challenges they face going back to work, having multiple children, trying to sleep train, not being comfortable letting a baby cry for 40 minutes, you know, whatever those are. And there's a vast range, but you know, the takeaway that I'm hearing is if you love your baby and you're doing your best, like they're going to be just fine. You know, yes. Could they grow faster and be healthier with better sleep health earlier? Absolutely. But it's not something if you are so stressed out as a parent, like your stress is very important as well. So I love all that. Meredith, tell us all the places you can find us because you are very active on Instagram too, which is really cool.
Yes, I'm at Sleep Dr. Mare on Instagram. And then my practice is called soundsleepguru.com. And you can find me there.
I love that. And anybody, they don't have to be local. You're virtual. So people from all over the country can work with you.
I only have a medical license in California and Washington. Okay. So those are the two states.
All right. Call out for California, Washington. But anybody can follow her on Instagram. Meredith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.